DC politicians want to enact harmful credit card mandates that could take away your cash back and rewards points. Perks that stretch your budget and make life a little easier. Losing these benefits means less money for your family's everyday essentials like gas and groceries. The perks you rely on could disappear, leaving you with higher costs and fewer options. Tell Congress to guard your card and oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card mandates.
Paid for by Electronic Payments Coalition.
Welcome to The Deep Dive. We're here to unpack your source material, pulling out all those crucial insights and bits of knowledge. Today, we're diving deep into what has to be one of the greatest comeback stories in modern music. We're talking Bonnie Raitt and her 10th studio album, Nick of Time.
Yeah, this is more than just an album deep dive, isn't it? It's really about a complete transformation. When this record came out, March 21st, 1989, it wasn't just successful. It felt like, well, vindication. It was this huge commercial and critical breakthrough. But it came after years, literal years, where the industry had basically written her off. She was fighting some serious personal demons, really struggling.
And the numbers alone just tell this incredible story of, well, resurrection, basically. Nick of Time didn't just make the top 10. It went all the way to number one on the Billboard 200, sold, what was it, 5 million copies. Astonishing. And then it just swept the 1990 Grammys. Three major wins, including the big one, Album of the Year, for her and producer Don Was.
Right. And you got to remember the context here. 1989, what was big? Synthesized pop, hair metal bands, new wave was still around. Mm. So for a blues rock veteran, someone nearly 40 who'd actually been dropped by her previous label, to come out with this kind of understated, really honest record and conquer the Grammys like that, it says so much about the album itself, its quality, its sincerity.
Absolutely. And its legacy is still growing, isn't it? This isn't just some nostalgia piece. We're talking about, you know, significant American art. In 2022, the Library of Congress picked Nick of Time for preservation. It's in the National Recording Registry now.
Yeah, that's the official recognition, right? Deemed culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant. That's about as big a validation as you can get. And that really sets up our mission today, I think. We need to trace that whole dramatic story. We have to understand just how deep the hole was that she climbed out of. How did Bonnie Raitt go from being, you know, broke, emotionally shattered, basically hitting rock bottom, to this massive industry-defining success? We'll look at the really cruel professional stuff she went through, the unexpected partnership she formed, and the kind of thematic honesty that just made this underdog record resonate so powerfully.
Okay, let's start there then. Let's look into that abyss, because you really can't appreciate the win without understanding how bad things got for her professionally between, say, 1983 and 1988.
Yeah, it's a tough part of the story, for sure. And the details really show you the harsh side of the music business. Raitt had been respected for years, you know, a real musician's musician. But her albums just weren't selling in the huge numbers major labels wanted. So the axe finally fell in 1983. Warner Bros. Records dropped her.
And the reason they gave was just purely business, right? The sales figures for The Glow in 79 and Greenlight in 82 just weren't good enough for them. Bottom line decision.
Exactly. Cold calculation. But here's where it gets almost unbelievably cruel. The timing. They made that decision to fire her one day after she'd finished recording her next album, an album she'd been working on, tentatively called Tongue in Groove.
Wow. Just think about that for a second. You finish this huge creative effort. The recording's done. You're probably feeling relieved, maybe even proud. You've poured everything into it. And then, bam, the next morning, you get the call. You're fired. It's like a professional gut punch right when you're most invested, most vulnerable.
And just when you think it couldn't get worse.
Yeah.
It does. She was fired, but the contract wasn't entirely severed. It still had power over her. So 2 years later, this is 1986 now, Warner Bros. Decides to exercise some weird contract option. They decide to distribute the material she'd recorded back then, the album they initially refused to release. And they retitle it Nine Lives.
Oh, that's just demoralizing, doesn't even cover it. So she's legally forced to promote an album she has no control over anymore, released by the very label that told her she wasn't worth investing in. She has to go out, tour, talk it up, and split the profits with the company that dumped her.
Exactly. She essentially had to promote her own professional failure, legally bound to it. It kept her tied to this past she desperately needed to move on from. And that financial drain, that creative humiliation, it all happened right alongside a major personal breakdown. The professional side was bad, yeah, but the sources are clear. Her whole life was kind of imploding in the mid-80s.
Right. There were relationship breakdowns, too. The end of her affair with producer Rob Fraboni around 85. But the money problems sound like they are the immediate trigger for things really spiraling.
Yeah, it got to the point where she couldn't even afford to pay her backing band anymore.
Yeah.
Imagine having to tell your band, the musicians who've been with you, your creative family, that you just can't pay them. The financial stress, the isolation, it created this vacuum.
And the sources say that led to some pretty destructive coping mechanisms. Understandable, maybe, but destructive. Severe depression set in. And Rate herself said she started dealing with it through excessive eating, drinking, and partying.
Yeah, and this wasn't just, you know, typical rock star behavior. This sounds like a serious, uncontrolled spiral driven by despair. She really summed up how bad it got. She admitted she hit absolute rock bottom. Her quote was, "I wasn't kicking and screaming into dementia, but I did have a complete emotional, physical, and spiritual breakdown."
That's a powerful quote. They suggest this quiet internal collapse, not some big public meltdown, just wreckage inside. So she's promoting Nine Lives, feeling completely broken, no direction. Which brings us to the next phase, the turning point. How do you possibly pull out of that kind of complete breakdown?
Well, the first bit of luck is almost like something out of a movie. And it comes via pop royalty. She's on the road, touring for Nine Lives, the album she hates promoting, and Prince attends her show. At the Beverly Theater in L.A. Yes, that Prince.
Wow. Okay. Prince was huge at Warner Bros. Then. Massive clout. He must have seen past all the industry nonsense and just heard the talent.
Absolutely. The sources say he was a fan, and when he found out she didn't have a contract, that she was basically adrift, he apparently just immediately offered her a deal.
Yeah.
Said, "Come join my label, Paisley Park Records." Rate, obviously seeing this as this incredible lifeline, this huge vote of confidence from someone like Prince, she agreed, went off to Minneapolis.
That must have felt like a genuine miracle, like a hand reaching down to pull her out. But even that wasn't the magic fix, was it? It was more like a change of scene before the real work had to begin.
Exactly. And that's where fate, or maybe just bad luck with good consequences, stepped in again. This time, it was physical. Before she could really get down to recording for Paisley Park, she had a skiing accident. A bad one. It put her in the hospital for 2 months.
So an injury, something that normally seems like a huge setback for an artist, actually became the catalyst for recovery.
Pretty much. It forced her to stop. The touring stopped, the partying had to stop, the constant worry about the next gig. All of it paused. And in that quiet, that enforced stillness, she had to look inward. And those 2 months gave her the space, the clarity, to realize that she needed to change things. Not just the industry, but her.
Right, that crucial moment of self-accountability.
Yeah, she was really honest with herself. She said something like, "It seemed that some changes needed to be made, and I looked at myself and just felt I wasn't being the best version of me as I could. I wasn't going to blame anyone other than myself."
No.
That shift, deciding not to blame everyone else, that's the real pivot from being a victim of circumstance to taking control.
And the concrete action that came out of that realization was sobriety, the big one.
Yes. She credits going to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings with giving her a totally new perspective on life. She got stable, emotionally, spiritually, but you know, getting sober doesn't magically fix your bank account.
Yeah.
The professional path was still incredibly bumpy.
And that initial hope, the Paisley Park deal, it didn't work out in the end.
No, it kind of fizzled. She ended up leaving Prince's label because apparently the album she envisioned just wasn't materializing the way she wanted. So she was still in a really tough spot financially. Couldn't afford a full band again. She ended up just playing acoustic shows, stripping everything back, just her guitar, the songs.
But it was in that stripped down, vulnerable state that she found the key collaborator for her comeback.
Exactly. Right in that raw performance setting, she connects with the musician Don Was.
Yeah.
Now, we need to pause here because Don Was, people knew him from the band Was, not Was, right, with his brother. And their sound was, well, pretty distinctive, very eclectic, quite slick, kind of funk, dance, new wave, pop fusion. Think Walk the Dinosaur or Spy in the House of Love.
Okay, yeah. So known for really polished production, funk pop stuff, seems like the absolute opposite of the raw, bluesy direction she'd eventually take. How did they connect?
It was almost random, really. Their first actual collaboration was on this quite unusual project in 1988, an album called Stay Awake, various interpretations of music from vintage Disney films. Rate sang Baby Mine from Dumbo for that album, produced by Woz. It's kind of wild to think that this career-defining partnership started on a Disney covers compilation.
Yeah, it's unexpected, but clearly something clicked between them. She liked working with him, trusted him enough to choose him as her producer for her own album. That says a lot about their connection, overlooking the genre expectations.
It really does. So, okay, she has Dawn was lined up as producer. She's sober, focused, but she still needs a record deal. And this is where you see just how skeptical the industry still was about her.
Her co-manager, Danny Goldberg, was shopping her around to labels. That must have been incredibly frustrating.
Oh, massively. Goldberg reported that at least 14 different record executives passed on signing Bonnie Raitt. 14. She wasn't seen as a hot prospect at all. She was widely considered, you know, commercially washed up, basically. A huge gamble, especially after the Nine Lives debacle just a couple of years before.
14 rejections, that's brutal. It shows just how completely the industry had written her off as someone who could sell records. So when Capitol Records finally bit, was it because they saw the artistic potential, or was the deal just really low risk for them?
It definitely sounds more like the latter. Tim Devine at Capitol Records was the one who finally took an interest. He saw something there, maybe sensed the change in her. But the deal she signed with Capitol in 1988, it wasn't huge. It was for $150,000, not exactly a bidding war. It was more like a cautious, fairly small bet on a veteran artist who was reliable, even if she hadn't had recent hits. And that detail is so important. It really underscores just how much of an underdog project Nick of Time was right from the very start.
$150,000 investment that turned into 5 million sales and 3 Grammys. Incredible. Okay, let's shift from the struggle to the actual creation. What did this partnership produce musically? What was the sound that ended up captivating everyone?
Well, the musical direction was very much a deliberate step away from the typical late 80s sound. The core sound of Nick of Time is, I'd say, smooth, but definitely not slick. It's understated rock with a real warmth and accessibility.
Yeah, I think Stephen Thomas Erlewine, the critic from AllMusic, he really nailed that sort of paradox in his description.
He did. Erlewine wrote that Raitt never rocks too hard, but there is grit to her singing and playing, even when the surfaces are clean and inviting. That word grit is key. This isn't bland adult contemporary. It's mature blues-based rock.
Yeah.
It sounds inviting, yeah, but it carries the weight of everything she'd been through.
It sounds like maturity, really. Bringing together all her influences without needing to be loud about it. You hear that amazing blend, Americana, rock, blues rock, but with touches of R&B, pop, even country woven in, it feels very whole.
And like we mentioned, given Don Was's background, people might have expected something funkier, maybe more dance-oriented, but Raitt and Was together made this very deliberate, almost countercultural artistic choice.
Why reject the trends? What was the thinking behind going against the grain of the late 80s sound?
It was explicitly framed as a return to her roots. They wanted to emphasize that laid-back blues rock feel. Critically, they aimed for less production, less slickness, which meant, you know, actively avoiding the gated reverb drums, the layers of synthesizers, the programmed beats that were everywhere back then. They wanted something timeless, not trendy. And that decision was probably crucial for the album's longevity. By stripping away that 80s production artifice, the focus landed squarely on the performance, the songwriting, the arrangements, and just the pure emotional power of her voice and that signature slide guitar.
Okay, let's drill down into the actual making of it, the production mechanics. Given that relatively small budget, $150K, and the goal of sounding less slick, how did they manage to get such a high-quality, professional, yet still kind of raw sound?
Well, efficiency was key. And preparation made that efficiency possible. Even before they had the Capitol deal finalized, Raitt and Was had been working together, recording early, very stripped-down demos at Was's home studio. This wasn't just practicing the songs. It was about figuring out which songs worked best with just the essentials, without needing a big band or lots of studio layers.
So they were already making sure the core of the music was strong, that it didn't rely on studio magic later on.
Exactly. It mirrored how she'd been playing live during those lean years, just acoustic, focusing on the song itself. Because they'd already worked out the arrangements and knew the material inside out from those demos, the actual studio recording process was remarkably fast.
How fast are we talking?
The main recording sessions happened over about a week. At Ocean Way Recording and a couple of other LA studios, they were apparently knocking out about 2 tracks per day, which for a major label album with top-tier musicians, recording 2 finished tracks a day is incredibly quick. That's almost punk rock speed, not what you expect for a Grammy-winning record.
And the engineer, Ed Cherney, He mentioned that the speed didn't actually hurt the quality. In fact, it helped create the album's core feeling.
Yeah, Chorney pointed out that most of the music was recorded live in the studio, which means the core band, bass, drums, piano, radon guitar, and vocals, they were all playing together in the same room at the same time. Mm-hmm. Capturing that interaction, that moment, it avoids that kind of sterile, pieced-together feel you can get when every instrument is recorded separately and perfectly layered.
Why is that live feel so important, especially for blues and roots music?
Well, that kind of music really thrives on the interplay between musicians. The little improvisations, the feel. Recording live captures that human groove, those slight imperfections that make it feel authentic. It demands amazing musicianship. Obviously, there's nowhere to hide mistakes. But when it works, like it did here, you get this warmth, this dynamic energy, this realness that became the signature of the album's appeal. That live feel is totally connected to the emotional honesty everyone praised.
Corporate megastores are spending millions lobbying DC politicians on one-sided policies that send small businesses tumbling. They want to enact harmful credit card mandates that take resources away from your local credit union and community bank, leaving Main Street businesses with less access to credit, making it harder for your family to pay for everyday goods like gas and groceries. Tell Congress to guard your card and oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card mandates.
Paid for by Electronic Payments Coalition.
Speaking of emotional honesty, let's talk themes. An album made right after hitting rock bottom, getting sober, it's bound to be reflective, right? This wasn't just songs, it was a statement about where she was in life.
Oh, absolutely. It was a very conscious shift towards adult themes, towards maturity. Her biographer, Mark Bidogo, he noted that the songs felt much more personal than her earlier stuff. She kind of moved away from the standard blues or rock themes, you know, the You Break My Heart songs or the rowdy party anthems, and really dug into deeper, more internal stuff. Adult relationships, self-reflection.
And the timing, her age, was a big part of that. She was nearly 40 when it came out, hitting that big milestone, middle age.
Yeah, and the title track, Nick of Time, deals with that head on. It's explicitly about coming to terms with middle age, that feeling of time speeding up, realizing maybe some doors are closing, or that you need to make changes now if you want to find fulfillment.
It almost sounds like it was deliberately aimed at the baby boomer generation, who are all hitting that same point of reflection around then.
Madonna definitely suggested that, that Rate was consciously making an album for her generation, reflecting their concerns, their relationships, their desire for something genuine in a pretty commercialized world. It was a mature record tackling mature subjects, sobriety, lasting love, self-acceptance. And it connected so deeply because her audience was right there with her, going through similar things.
What's really interesting, though, is how much of this deeply personal statement was actually made through cover songs. The album's got 11 tracks, runs about 42 minutes, but only two songs were written solely by Rate herself. The title track, Nick of Time, and The Road's My Middle Name.
Right. It really highlights her skill as an interpreter, as a curator. Choosing covers wasn't just about filling the album. She found songs by other writers that perfectly articulated the emotional territory she wanted to explore. Writers like John Hiatt, his thing called Love, just perfectly captures that kind of mature, comfortable joy and commitment. And Bonnie Hayes, who wrote Love Letter and Have a Heart, which have that really introspective quality.
So she used these outside songs, like pieces of a puzzle, building this cohesive thematic picture. It let her channel her own new perspective, the sobriety, the stability, the grown-up love, through lyrics written by others, but delivered with the full weight of her own lived experience.
That's it, exactly. Anyone can sing a cover song. But Rate inhabited these songs. Her voice, which had been roughed up by life but was now newly clear and energized by sobriety, gave such authenticity to the material. They felt like her own stories, even if she didn't write the words.
Okay, let's get into the personnel now, Section V. Despite that modest $150K advance and the tight recording schedule, the list of musicians who played on this album is seriously impressive. A real who's who.
It absolutely is. And that speaks volumes about the respect Bonnie Raitt commanded among fellow musicians, even when her commercial stock was low. Great players, they recognized talent and integrity. Having these names on the credits basically validated the whole project before it even hit the stores.
So beyond Rate herself, who handled vocals, electric piano, her amazing slide guitar work, and other guitars who were the core players.
Well, obviously Don was producing, setting that sonic tone. And Ed Cherney engineering and mixing, capturing that clean but live sound. But the band playing with her, really top notch.
Who laid down the foundation? The rhythm section.
That crucial groove came from James Hutch, Hutchinson on bass, and Ricky Fattar on drums.
Hmm.
These guys are seasoned pros. They play with incredible taste, never too busy, never too slick, just solid, supportive, mature playing that lets Russ's voice and guitar really breathe and shine.
And then there are the guest appearances, which definitely add another layer of credibility, don't they?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the biggest name on the album, undeniably, is Herbie Hancock. Playing acoustic piano on track 10, I Ain't Gonna Let You Break My Heart Again, Herbie Hancock, a true legend of jazz, fusion. His presence alone sends a signal to everyone, critics, listeners, that this is a serious musical undertaking, not just some quick comeback attempt.
What did Hancock specifically bring to that track, musically?
He brings this harmonic sophistication, you know. It lifts the song beyond just a simple blues ballad. His touch is just exquisite, often subtle. But the chords he chooses, the way he voices them, it adds this layer of elegance and complexity that really deepens the emotional impact of the song. It wasn't just name-dropping. It was casting the perfect musician for that specific mood.
There was a strong horn section too, right?
Yeah, the heart attack horns. They were key for adding that bit of soul, that R&B edge on tracks like Have a Heart. You're talking about Bill Bergman, Greg Smith, John Berry Jr., Dennis Farias. A really tight, powerful section that adds energy, but again, never overpowers the main groove. They kept that balanced grit, but not slickness.
And finally, the vocals. Who was supporting her on harmonies?
The backing vocal lineup was pretty stacked, too. You had incredible session singers like Sir Harry Bowens, Arnold McCullough, Sweet P. Atkinson, guys known for their power and soul. But the real star power, in terms of harmony, came from David Crosby and Graham Nash singing backup on Cry on My Shoulder.
Crosby and Nash, legends of harmony. What kind of impact did having them on the record make?
Well, instantly, you've got rock royalty lending their voices. And their specific harmonic blend is iconic, instantly recognizable. Their presence just underlined the fact that, despite her struggles, Raitt still had this deep network of respect within the music community. They brought those intricate, beautiful harmonies they're famous for, adding this richness and texture. It was like a signal that the folk rock establishment was fully behind her return. Really, the whole personnel list reads like a statement of trust from the best in the business.
That musical support was clearly there. But now, as we move into the commercial success story, we have to go back to the business side. Even with the album finished, getting it marketed by Capitol Records was still a battle.
Yeah, the resistance inside the label was pretty significant. You have to remember, Raitt was known, yes, but she was known for not selling huge numbers recently. So Capitol's marketing department was really reluctant to throw much money behind promoting her. They saw it as a big risk.
So it took Tim Devine, the executive who signed her, to really push for it.
Absolutely. Devine apparently had to go directly to the president of Capitol just to get approval for basic things, like putting full-page ads in music magazines. This wasn't launched with a massive coordinated media campaign. It was a record that had to fight for attention both inside the building and out in the world.
And the way it sold really shows that. It wasn't an instant smash hit. It was the absolute definition of a slow burn.
Totally. It debuted pretty low on the Billboard 200 chart, like number 105. It sold steadily, though, right from the start. Became her best-selling album to date fairly quickly, which was already a win. But its journey to the very top, that took an incredibly long time.
How long are we talking?
It took over a year. Consistent sales, growing critical acclaim, lots of positive word of mouth, building and building from its release in March 89 all the way until April 6, 1990. That's when Nick of Time finally hit number one. I mean, think about today's music world. Albums debut high based on pre-orders and first-week streams, then often drop quickly. A 13-month climb to number one. It's basically unheard of now.
And that slow climb wasn't just impressive. It actually set a record.
Yeah, a really fascinating chart record that says so much about her persistence. The time between Bonnie Raitt's first album ever charting on the Billboard 200, that was Give It Up way back in 1972, and Nick of Time hitting number one in 1990, was 17 and a half years. That broke the record for the longest time it ever took an artist to reach number one after their first chart appearance. It wasn't just a comeback hit. It was like proof that quality and sticking with it could eventually move the system.
So what kept that momentum going for so long? It couldn't have just been touring, right? They needed radio play, maybe some visuals.
Definitely. The singles were important. Nick of Time itself, Love Letter, they did okay. But Thing Called Love, and especially Have a Heart, were the ones that got significant radio play. Have a Heart actually cracked the top 50 on the Billboard Hot 100, hitting number 49. That gave it the crossover push it needed, getting played on pop stations, not just rock or blues formats.
And Mark Bago, the biographer, he highlights the music video for Thing Called Love as being pretty important too, especially for reaching a new audience.
Yeah, that's a great point for that era.
Yeah.
The late 80s, early 90s, MTV and VH1 were huge. That video is a smart way to reintroduce Bonnie Raitt to a younger generation who might have only known her vaguely, if at all. And the video itself was effective because it was simple, charismatic. Just Raitt playing in a bar, looking great, energetic, flirting with Dennis Quaid, who played a patron. It sold her personality or magnetism, showed she was still relevant and cool.
Okay, so we've got the quality music, the emotional depth, the slow, steady marketing push, the video. But if you had to boil it down, why did this record at this moment connect so deeply that it sold 5 million copies and became this defining comeback?
Her publicist at the time, Joan Myers, probably had the simplest and maybe the best explanation. She put it down entirely to Raitt's authenticity. Myers said, "Bonnie's personality and sincerity just won people's hearts. In addition to her music, there was nothing ever pretentious about her."
Okay, let's unpack that word sincerity in the context of 1989. The late 80s, as we said, lots of big hair, big production, maybe some manufactured images out there. Why did her specific brand of authenticity cut through so strongly then?
I think it cut through because it felt like an antidote, you know, an alternative to all the gloss and excess of the time. People were maybe getting tired of the artifice and were hungry for something real. And the narrative surrounding the album, the artist who battled addiction, got sober, found maturity, and made this honest record about real life that created a powerful emotional connection. It wasn't about fantasy. It was about resilience, about growth. Especially for that boomer audience who were doing their own soul searching, this album felt like a genuine companion, an honest voice talking about things they were actually experiencing.
And it wasn't just a U.S. phenomenon. The album did well internationally too, suggesting that message resonated more broadly.
Yeah, while North America was definitely the main driver, it hit number 4 up in Canada. It charted respectably across Europe too.
Mm.
Made number 51 in the UK, popped up on the charts in Australia, Germany, the Netherlands. That core message of reflection, sincerity, it clearly translated.
Which brings us nicely to the ultimate validation, the critical acclaim, specifically that massive Grammy night. The commercial success was huge, but the industry recognition cemented its place in music history.
Oh, the 1990 Grammys were just total vindication. It's worth repeating the wins because they were so significant. Nick of Time wins the biggest award, Album of the Year. And then the title track, the song Nick of Time, it does this amazing double winning Best Female Rock Vocal Performance and Best Female Pop Vocal Performance.
Winning across different genre categories like that, plus taking the top prize, that's a huge statement from the same industry that had basically given up on her just a few years earlier.
It's the ultimate turnaround narrative, isn't it? To go from being fired, forced to promote an album your old label dumped on the market, to standing on that Grammy stage accepting Album of the Year, especially after signing for just $150,000. It's the definitive story of triumph over adversity. It wasn't just a win for her. It felt like the industry acknowledging, wow, we really missed the boat on this one.
And that recognition, as we mentioned earlier, it wasn't just a one-night thing. The album was immediately recognized as important, getting included in those key best-of lists, like the Book 1001 Albums You Must Hear Before You Die.
Yeah, it instantly became part of the canon, required listening. Although it's interesting to look at how its critical standing, particularly in big publications like Rolling Stone, has maybe shifted a bit over the decades.
Right, if you track its position on Rolling Stone's 500 Greatest Albums of All Time list.
Exactly. In the first version, 2003, Nick of Time was ranked pretty high, number 229. Then in the 2012 update, it held steady, basically, at 230. But in the most recent version, the 2020 list, it dropped quite a bit, down to number 492.
Wow, yeah, that's a significant drop. From the top half down to almost the very end, what do you think that means for its legacy?
Well, it doesn't necessarily mean critics think less of the album itself. It often reflects how critical tastes change, how subsequent generations reassess eras. Maybe there's been a renewed focus on other sounds from the late 80s or early 90s grunge alternative hip-hop that were perhaps seen as more groundbreaking or culturally disruptive. Those shifts might push more polished, adult-oriented rock albums down the list. But, I mean, the crucial thing is it's still on the list. That confirms its enduring quality and impact, even if its relative position fluctuates with critical trends.
And regardless of where it sits on a magazine list, that final stamp of historical importance came much more recently.
Right, the Library of Congress selecting it in 2022 for the National Recording Registry. That preservation honor, deeming it culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant, that ensures the album and its story, this pivotal moment for Rate, bringing mature themes to the mainstream, is saved and recognized permanently for its cultural value.
The whole journey, from hitting rock bottom to this massive breakthrough, it's just such a powerful lesson in resilience, in artistic truth. Let's try and pull together the most potent parts of this story one last time for everyone listening.
Yeah, I think it really boils down to two things. Just how bad things got for her initially, and how pure and honest her artistic response was. We started with Bonnie Raitt getting dropped by Warner Bros., being legally tied to promoting Nine Lives, this record she hated, and hitting that personal low point, that complete emotional, physical, and spiritual breakdown she talked about.
Then came that unexpected forced pause, the skiing accident, which led her to the absolutely critical, life-changing decision to get sober. And that clarity, that new perspective, allowed her to connect with Dawn was maybe an unlikely choice on paper, but the perfect producer for her. And then after being turned down 14 times, she gets that relatively small $150,000 deal from Capitol.
And from that modest beginning, she creates this absolute masterpiece.
A blues rock album, recorded quickly, mostly live, focused entirely on personal honesty, growing older, finding stability. It felt real. It had grit. And it connected universally because it came from such a genuine place, not from trying to chase trends.
And that authenticity, backed up by relentless touring and incredible word of mouth, that's what fueled the slow, steady climb up the charts for over a year, leading to that historic 17.5-year record and the Grammy for Album of the Year. She redefined her entire career completely on her own terms.
And that mechanism, that slow burn success, is really fascinating to think about now. The steady touring, the critical buzz building over time. That's what pushed the album forward. The music resonated. The themes of reflection and sobriety felt true because they were so clearly rooted in her real life struggles and recovery. People trusted the story because the music felt absolutely authentic. Which brings us to a final thought, something for you, the listener, to consider as we wrap up this deep dive. We've talked about this incredible 17.5-year gap for Rate to hit number one and how her success was built layer by layer, touring, word of mouth, quality enduring over time, not initial hype. So the question is, in today's music world, with its intense focus on instant hits, viral moments, first week streams, how likely is it that a similar kind of slow burn masterpiece, an album built on deep personal experience that needs time to find its audience, could ever achieve that same kind of ultimate deserved success? Are we maybe losing the space for albums that take a year to truly connect and climb?
That's definitely something to think about, considering how quickly things move today. Thanks for joining us for the deep dive.
Until next time.